This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Deportation contagions. In the age of COVID-19, anything other than ending deportations is a high-risk, potentially disastrous move. Joining us from San Salvador is Jorge Coija, professor of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean studies at Dartmouth College. During the heightened lockdown of Central American countries due to the novel coronavirus, returned migrants and asylum seekers are still being funneled through the expulsion system from the United States and Mexico back to their countries of origin. So we're going to start there, but not before I say that we are recording you or speaking to you from San Salvador. And I do want to know how things are there, how San Salvador is being affected by the coronavirus before we get into the meat of our discussion.
Great. Thank you for having me, Mimi. And well, here in San Salvador, things are pretty much locked down, as you correctly note. People are not going outside. There's only one designated person per family who can go outside to gather the basic necessities, such as food and medicine. There's many police checkpoints that also double as sanitation stations throughout the country, and many people without legitimate reasons to be outside the quarantine are taken into custody. And up to today, about 700 people have been detained by the police and the armed forces for not having a legitimate reason to be outside. This has created a tense situation of kind of intimidation by police forces and people kind of fearful that the virus is spreading and that the government isn't offering clear and transparent figures as to its spread.
Well, amidst this, going to the question that the heightened lockdown of Central American countries, presumably, which was due to the coronavirus, again, returned migrants and asylum seekers are still being funneled through the expulsion system from the United States and Mexico back to their countries of origin. So let's get into the meat of what you've been writing about and thinking about, which is indeed this expulsion, this deportation system, which, if anything, has been ramped up in the U.S.
Yes, indeed. So the deportation question to me is a fundamental question to be asking in this moment of pandemic. When we think about the squalor in detention centers, the lack of medical attention within the U.S. immigration system, the fact that deportations and expulsions are persisting even amidst the spread of the coronavirus is to me kind of a reckless situation that can only cause further harm and spread the virus to Central American nations that at this point in time have less confirmed cases than the U.S. combined. And so it's this moment where the Trump administration and the immigration system is kind of foregoing all the measures that Central American nations are taking to safeguard and protect their citizens and quarantine people to stop the spread of the coronavirus, yet these kinds of safe third country agreements, migrant policy protocols in the case of Mexico, are still being placed into full effect despite what's going on. And to me, this is a kind of a very tense situation where all the efforts that countries are taking are being sort of dismissed or discarded by the U.S., who continues to push people through. I was just reading recently that in Guatemala specifically, the country received more deportees in the month of March than it did in January and February of this year. And this is, like you said, it's ramping up, it's intensifying, and all the protocols that ICE is supposedly taking to assure receiving countries, in this case Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, that these deportees are exhibiting no symptoms of the coronavirus are inadequate. So what ICE is doing now is taking temperature checks and doing kind of visual observation and to detect whether or not folks are infected with COVID-19. But what we're seeing, especially in the Guatemalan case, is that despite these supposed new mechanisms to detect coronavirus, Guatemala has received now three deportees that have been found to be infected by COVID-19. So it's clearly not working. And what I've been writing about and trying to think through is why does this persist, given that the general kind of rule or the common sense is to reduce non-essential travel, to lock down and to keep everybody in homes, which I think is what many activists and immigration defenders in the United States have been pushing for, with freeing them all and having folks do domestic quarantine rather than being the kind of petri dish of the detention center. Yet despite this, it continues, right? And so part of my thinking has been how safe third country agreements and migrant protection protocols, also known as the Remain in Mexico initiative, have superseded what Central American governments have attempted to do to face the pandemic.
Let's get into the meat of that, because curiously, deportation flights had temporarily halted in Guatemala, and they've restarted again, mm-hmm. and that's without us talking about, which we will, the conditions within the detention centers here. But how do you understand that, and what is the nature of the political relationship that we are taking an already vulnerable population and from our detention centers, which are like a sardine can for or petri just for breeding coronavirus, and transporting people, deporting them out of the country? How do you understand the politics of the relationship between the U.S., Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, that this is the situation?
Like I mentioned, these safe third country agreements and the migrant protection protocols are superseding any efforts by Central American nations to close down borders, to stop commercial travel, non-essential travel. And it shows to me this kind of recurrent script of subservience from Central America to the United States, where the United States is able to, regardless of the conditions of the crisis in the global system, able to impose foreign policy, or in this case, immigration policy in the region, regardless of what Central American nations purport to do. Specifically in El Salvador, I can speak on that.
Please,
the president, Nayib Bukele, shut down the international airport to all travel except for cargo and humanitarian aid. Where in that do deportation flights exist, right? And clearly we're seeing that there's a lot of back channeling going on. This situation changes every other week. As you notice, Guatemala has had a kind of an on and off relationship with deportation flights in the last month or so. But in the end, the U.S. embassies in these countries articulate the policy of ongoing deportations, that they will continue, that there's no legitimate reason why they should stop. The only modification that has taken place in the last month has been that Central American nations will now receive only their nationals back. So Guatemala for Guatemalans, Salvadorans to El Salvador, and Hondurans to Honduras. But the Safe Third Country Agreement stipulated that any of these three countries could receive nationals from any of the other two countries. So this has been a slight modification, but it hasn't really stopped the numbers, right? The numbers are still the same, if not slightly upticked. This is the situation of the deportations, and the politics around it has been the situation where Central American nations need to appease the Trump administration because of conditional aid, because of other things that are sort of taking place around things like temporary protective status in the United States that might be jeopardized if Central American nations backpedal on these third country agreements and protection protocols that were signed into effect last year.
Jorge Aquila, also talk about how this pandemic has also enabled authoritarian and constitutional erosions via state of emergency measures to deepen inequality and violence in countries such as Honduras, etc.
So what I've seen in the case of Honduras and El Salvador, which I'll take together, in Honduras, for example, there's a leader, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who is, for all intents and purposes, been linked to narco trafficking, is a leader who has been accused and proved to engage in corrupt practices, has funded his reelection campaign by gutting the healthcare system in Honduras. And this has created, at least in Honduras, a situation where there is absolutely no confidence or trust in public institutions, and has created, from the side of the government, a need to respond with ever-increasing and intensifying measures to control people, to keep them indoors, to not spread the virus, to not disregard public health measures. But the form that these measures have taken, which has often been through intensifying policing, creating more police presence out in the streets, has created a situation where people are instead intimidated by the police forces and are fearful of the virus, rather than creating a situation where the police and the armed forces can serve a kind of educated role and actually explain to people what these new intensifying and increasing and ever-evolving measures actually mean in terms of how they should live their daily lives. So this has been a kind of pressure point in Honduras, and one that is also mirrored in El Salvador, where we have a president who has been also very public with the ways that is seeking to rule El Salvador with a kind of iron fist. Let's think back to the events of February 9th in El Salvador, where President Bukele stormed the National Assembly with a military entourage in order to push the Assembly to fund his new crime bill and security plan. And so this coronavirus and the pandemic hit Central America in a moment where the sanctity of public institutions is being violated, democracy is withering, and we're seeing the kind of taking stage of these figures who are seeking to control society by whatever means necessary. Just yesterday, President Bukele went on the air and addressed the nation that if anyone is found to be violating domestic quarantine, the police and the armed forces are authorized to bend some wrists and to impound vehicles. And this kind of saying this publicly, given the history, the recent history of Central America, of Honduras and El Salvador specifically, is reckless, is irresponsible, and in fact leaves much of the controlling of the virus up to the discretion of officers and armed forces who themselves have oftentimes been embroiled in human rights abuses, in excesses of force that doesn't bode well for citizens and for the erosions of their constitutional rights.
Jorge, also talk about, there's another element to this, what you call the deportation machine, which is juxtaposing, if you will, the enormity of the bailouts that are being proposed and indicated for the airlines in the U.S. to the tune of $50 billion, and that emits and within the $2 trillion economic recovery stimulus that was pumped into this system, not to mention how many people are left out of that equation. But notwithstanding that, talk about the issue of the airlines, where they fit into the deportation of people back to Central America as we're bailing out, you know, mega corporations who also had enormous benefits in terms of their stockholders, et cetera, in the recent years.
So the airline bailout, which is part of the $2 trillion economic stimulus, includes airlines like United, American, Delta. These corporations, these airlines have benefited, have been long-term benefiting from ICE contracts to deport people and to send them back to places like Central America. And so what we're seeing in terms of last year, about 1,200 commercial airlines from these various American airlines, United and Delta, which are part of this American airline lobbying group, have used about 1,200 commercial flights to send people back to their countries of origin. And this is a pretty sizable contract that ICE has with these airlines. And so when we think about the stimulus plan, it must be linked to these other dependencies that are created by the existing sort of airline system, with deportation, with immigration, which are actually the very infrastructures that are used to send people back to the countries of origin. So these revenue streams, again, the airlines revenue streams, are intimately connected to immigration control and expulsion, all the way from these big airlines. But then there's also the charter flights that I don't make mention in my piece, but Eastern Airlines, there's a couple of other ones that are under ICE contracts primarily, and that's the lifeblood of these companies. And so when we think about the bailouts, they must be linked to this. And they're part of this entire ecosystem where many are profiting from the deportation of people back to Central America, and where even commercial airlines themselves are in some ways sort of preserved and helped out by the increasing numbers of people being deported, because for them it would equal more flights or more seats sold to the U.S. government via various kinds of arrangements that the U.S. government has with commercial airlines through this city partners program that has created a kind of mutually beneficial relationship where the U.S. can gets discounted airfares for per person on these commercial flights. And, well, that's business for the airlines themselves.
So the whole issue, of course, of facing deportation proceedings in U.S. courts is, and still arresting people throughout the country to house them in prison-like. They are prison detention centers. The deportation machinery, as I indicated, it is still very much revved up here. And I wonder if you can just, for the moment, direct yourself to that, and then we'll talk about the deportations. What is it your understanding of what is happening in the deportation centers and the detention centers that exist in this country?
What I'm seeing in the United States is that the same squalid conditions and lack of medical attention that has been given to migrant detainees persists, and this, coupled with the pandemic, is only exacerbating those already existing deficiencies in the care of migrants within detention centers. And so this is a kind of a pressure cooker that's waiting to explode. If any indication of, for example, New Jersey is a clear example here, where we have the virus actually having entered into the detention centers and infected people there, both detainees but also workers who travel in and out of the detention center. This, to me, is only going to increase, because I think that what ICE is doing is not enough in terms of actually testing folks, because these temperature controls that they're implementing are clearly inadequate. Many people are often asymptomatic and will never express the kinds of symptoms and flu-like symptoms that they're looking for. And so this is very, very irresponsible. And so what I'm seeing in the United States is that this will intensify. And for example, in Washington State, I believe there's been a kind of hunger strike by some detainees in order to bring attention to their conditions within the centers, within these prison-like conditions, in order to get some kind of relief and some kind of even information from the people that manage the detention center as to the state of the virus within those environments. And so there's also been this kind of lack of information for people on the inside to really get a sense of what's going on, and that kind of uncertainty creates even more panic, more fear, right, coupled with already known kind of the pre-existing conditions of the detention system that are unable to care for people within them.
Jorge Cuellar, is there any answer other than really the immediate release of detainees who are workers who are fleeing for their lives and fleeing in order to be able to live? And we certainly think that the issue of poverty and the unequal distribution of wealth is particularly relevant in the third world, having lived through the imperial relationships of countries like ours that have ripped them to shreds economically and politically. Is there any answer beyond that in the immediate? And then the question of what must be a long-range policy to stop, in any event, these deportations as far as you see it.
From the point of view of Central America, what the diaspora, what people from the international community, what human rights observers can really do in the immediate moment is to call to question the policy decisions and the kind of authoritarian turn that's taking place in Central America, even before the pandemic sort of took over our thinking. And it's keeping our eye on that will be useful to articulate better the conditions that are taking place in the region to help folks that are in detention, that are going through the asylum process, to better mount a kind of defense as to the conditions in the region to ensure folks' safety and their reception of asylum. That's one thing that, to me, in the immediate can be something we can do. And I think my humble contribution has been to articulate some of those concerns and some of those political changes that are taking place every day in Central America that from outside the region look like things are sort of coming, getting under control. There's less crime, there's more movement of capital, there's less violence, this kind of thing. But that is, to me, a kind of smokescreen as to what's really taking place on the ground, where people are being clamped down, where this lockdown that's taking place due to the pandemic is a kind of opportune moment for many Central American leaders to flex their muscles and to impose certain kinds of curfews that I think and I perceive will persist beyond the pandemic. But from the perception of folks in the United States, this might look like things are getting better, things are more sort of under control and disciplined, leading to less migrants leaving the country. But what's happening is actually a total lockdown of the region that's connected to these larger U.S. policies of basically making Central America into a kind of quarantine in and of itself that persists beyond COVID-19. So we need to really kind of pay attention to what these policies are doing, the inhumanity of them all in terms of the migrant policy protocols. For example, children are being repelled at the U.S.-Mexico border with kind of these expedited mechanisms. And it's this kind of situation where our attention should be placed as to what's happening underneath the corona panic discourse that's above all of this. There's a lot of fundamental changes that are happening in Central America right now at the level of constitutional erosions, the increasing policing and militarization of society that, from my perception of studying the region, will be things that linger beyond the quote-unquote end of the COVID-19 crisis. And it's paying attention to these things to better articulate an account of the world that Central Americans are living today, compounded, of course, by poverty, by insecurity, by food scarcity, by the rapacious changes of the climate that are affecting livelihoods, that are all kind of coming together right now underneath the pandemic.
Jorge, you've been terrific. I really want to thank you for taking the time to be with us and encourage you to still stay safe politically, health-wise in San Salvador, and to continue to do the theoretical and activist work that you do for us to really envision a progressive immigration policy and to remediate the damage that has incurred under the Trump administration, and looking forward to a path to legalization for the undocumented and long-term policies that emanate from workers' rights and workers' rights internationally. So thanks so much, really. And you were great. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, too, Mimi.
I hope we got out all the major points that you wish to.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think what you just mentioned now about workers' rights and kind of accompanying social movements on the ground here is another one that I should mention. And we need to really think about what they're doing, how Salvadoran feminists and Honduran feminists are articulating a society outside of the kind of patriarchal and authoritarian norms that have become part of Central American governance that need to be checked. And I think there's elements of civil society that are moving in that direction alongside human rights defenders that are calling attention to the excesses of force that these governments are trying to sort of make normal under pandemic conditions. And I think that's another kind of transnational aspect of this where groups in the United States might look to what activists on the ground are doing and collaborate to better, again, account for, do deportation defense, make asylum claims, and narrate the realities of the region and try to envision a different kind of Central America that's more hospitable.
Yeah. Well, that's saying a lot. That encompasses a great deal. We've been speaking with Jorge Colija, Professor of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean Studies at Dartmouth College.
This This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.